As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from the Times. It's International Week, or Week of Football, as UEFA like to call it. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I'm especially excited because this week we've gone for quality, not quantity. That's right. There's no James Scowcroft, no Alison Rudd, no Matt Hughes, no Matthew Syed, no Henry Winter. We've actually gone and picked two of the very best. In fact, the guys who rank at number one and number two in our survey of Game Podcast listeners, of favorite guests, they are Ollie Kay and Julian Lawrence. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on. This was, of course, a special listener's choice edition of the Game Podcast, and everybody wanted you two guys on ahead of everybody else. So it's a testament to your many appearances and your huge contributions to the podcast over the years.
In what order?
Actually, it's not. Basically, it's International Week. Nobody's around, and so Julian and Ollie, you guys get to join me. Okay, let's talk about Big Sam Allardyce's debut. Ollie, you're just back, and my obvious question is, which is the real England? Is it the first hour, or is it the last half hour? And if it's the last half hour, should you be a little bit concerned, because most of the time, they won't be playing against 10 men?
I'd say the real England is a team of which is capable of playing, you know, miserably for 45 minutes and reasonably well for 45 minutes. I thought that was the case quite often at the Euros, and it was the case yesterday. I thought the first half was, you know, it was as if nothing had changed, and probably nothing really fundamentally has changed because Allardyce only had them for, you know, a week. It's all the same players, which is inevitable because there are, you know, loads more players waiting to get through. It's a young squad anyway. It's still it's a squad that is still developing and now under new management. I thought after that poor first half, which, you know, it was just slow. There was no real energy to it. The three midfielders were too deep, really. Kane was very isolated. I thought the second half, and albeit yes, after Skirtle got sent off, but I thought the second half was much more encouraging. With I think the big pluses there were Dele Alli coming on and injecting a bit of excitement and impetus and quality going forward, and John Stones stepping up.
Okay, so what was I'm going to just stick with you, Ollie, though. What was different in terms of the things? I mean, leaving aside the performance on one side, because obviously there's only so much a manager can do about that, but did you notice anything different tactically? Anything different in terms of the movement or positioning of certain players?
Well, if you were to call that sort of 4-1-4-1 formation, I'd say that at the Euros, that central midfield area, it was Dyer deep, and it was Rooney and Ali quite a way ahead of him. And yesterday, it seemed like those three were almost operating in a line at times. I mean, obviously, Dyer was deepest, but Rooney and Henderson were often deep with him, and I didn't think that really worked in the first half. But whereas we saw at the Euros, we saw England often starting quite well actually in games and then running out of ideas dramatically. So against Iceland, they actually started very, very slowly and then tweaked things, and then with Ali coming on and Stones driving forward a lot more, I thought it was a team that sort of in intensity improved as the game went on. Maybe that's maybe that, I mean, you could say that was, well, he got it wrong by leaving Ali on the bench, but the substitution worked. I thought there was more quality once Ali came on, more quality when Stones is dropping forward or moving forward. I still say that there would be a question mark about the way he deployed Rooney, or indeed the way Rooney deployed himself, which I'm sure we'll get onto.
Yeah, we'll get to Rooney in a minute. Julian, did you agree with that? Is that, do you think that was the one notable difference, 4-3-3 instead of 4-1-4-1?
I didn't see much difference, I have to say. I thought it was boring. Even the last 30 minutes, I was disappointed.
It's not his job to make it exciting.
How can Dele Alli didn't start a game like this is beyond me.
He didn't start for Spurs, right? Was it the last game or the one before?
The one before. It's not because he didn't start for Spurs that he can't start for England against Slovakia away in a game where you know you need someone between the lines, and you know, because Sam said that, you know, he clearly doesn't have any control on Wayne Rooney, that he knows Wayne Rooney is not going to do that. So Henderson is not going to do that. Dyer is not going to do that. You've got two wingers and no one played between the lines in that first half. Hence the first shot on target after 64 minutes. How is that even possible that there's no shot on target before the 64th minute?
Well, they started very, very slowly. I agree with Julian. The midfield balance just didn't work at all for the first hour. I actually thought the last half hour was really decent. I mean, it looked like it was going to end 0-0, and I tweeted at that point, I'm seeing a lot of criticism of the performance. I think the last half hour has been good. I thought the goal when it came was deserved, and it actually reminded me quite a lot of Man United's game at Hull the previous week, where, you know, a common theme would be the wailing about Rooney, but it was a performance that really improved, went from very slow and lethargic to a lot more dynamic, a lot more imaginative, a lot more purposeful as the game went on. I'm really not saying it was great. I'm not, but I do think they deserve to win that game 1-0.
We have to talk about this, and some people will be bored by it. But I'm wondering, Wayne Rooney, he comes out before the game and he talks about retiring after the World Cup in Russia. And I was on a show with Paul Mariner, former England international, and he was appalled by that because, well, A, he doesn't like the idea of players retiring from international football. It's not your decision to make. But it was more the idea that, kind of in saying that, it's almost like you're putting pressure on, and maybe this isn't part of, maybe Rooney isn't quite that manipulative, but you're putting pressure on the England manager saying, all right, well, then you kind of got to pick him through 2018. Did you see it that way, Julian?
It looked to me all this week that it was Rooney's team. You know, that...
Well, he's the captain.
But this is not his team. Rooney can't do whatever he wants on the pitch. You know, when Rooney, he's 30 years old, he's clearly not in his best years. You know, there's clearly a problem with his positioning, both with club and country, like Oli wrote it this morning very nicely. But he sounded like he was the boss, you know. And then Sam afterwards saying like, yeah, he can do whatever he wants. It's just like, I'm flabbergasted by the whole Rooney.
Okay, so then let's just knock this on the head. Then we're saying that Sam Allardyce and Roy Hodgson both feel that if Wayne Rooney, in the hole, I guess, because that's roughly where he plays for Manchester United, and, you know, slightly deeper with England today, they both feel that the best thing to do is to have him on the pitch. He's the England captain, and give him this level of freedom and responsibility. This is a decision that Hodgson and Allardyce both reach the same conclusion independently.
Well, is it not the same conclusion that David Moyes and Louis van Gaal and indeed Jose Mourinho have reached?
I mean,
you could say certainly this season that Manchester United have such options in attacking areas that perhaps he's on borrowed time there. But it's not like, I think there's a strange thing with the Rooney debate where it's almost like people are absolutely, you know, people are desperate to make out he's a terrible player, and then there are people who not many, a declining number, who suggest he's still brilliant. And he's clearly neither. He's a once brilliant player whose very best years were quite a long time ago, not 2 years, 3 years, but probably 7 or 8 years, or even longer. But he's still a very good player for United and England. It's not a surprise to me that he's starting regularly for United and England. I think over the next 6 to 12 months, or maybe 18 months, maximum, probably he will probably be phased out of both of those teams and probably end up on the bench and, you know, a sort of non-playing captain. If that's the case,
if you think he will be phased out, mm-hmm. why give him so much responsibility now when you're actually trying to build a team and a unit? When you know that if you're going to phase him out, why not give somebody else a shot? And I'm talking about England. I mean, I think United is a completely different situation. Is that the argument that some people might make?
Yes, it certainly is, and that is a reasonable point. But Jose Mourinho seems to have looked at Rooney and thought,
Let's not bring Jose into this.
But it's the same.
It's not the same because Mkhitaryan is new to the team. So is Dele Alli.
Marcus Rashford and all these players that people are suggesting should be in the team, in the England team ahead of Rooney. And it's very similar where the manager has made a pragmatic decision to stick with Rooney, not alienate him, not exile him, not isolate him in the squad. Had Guardiola taken over at Man United, or had a different manager taken over at England, maybe they would have made a different call on Rooney, and they would have been free to do so without any commercial pressures or anything like that. But these managers, Allardyce, Mourinho, the same as Van Gaal did, the same as Hodgson, have made the decision that he's a guy who they need in the team at the moment. If he's in the team, he's captain. And all I would really quibble with over that is, I don't think he should be some untouchable who plays where he wants. I think he should be a guy who is probably hanging on to his place in the team. And I think that is a more realistic appraisal of where Rooney is at.
So, right, Julian, not a fan of...
I think there's a time to move on.
You're saying it's a time to move on. Yeah. And whereas Ollie Kay would like to see Rooney as player manager of the team.
Exactly.
For 10 years.
We're going to move on now, but we're going to stay with Manchester United because it's actually a bit of a treat. Ollie wrote a book, as you may or may not know, earlier this year about a guy named Adrian Doherty, who was kind of like the other Giggs. He was a contemporary of Giggs. Legend has it, or not legend, but a lot of real live people say that at United's Academy at the time, which I believe was still the Cliff, right?
Yep.
He was a better prospect than Ryan Giggs. And you may be wondering why you've not heard about him. I think it's a fantastic story. We don't just have Ollie on to help him peddle his book. What happened next? So he's at that age. Why did he not become Ryan Giggs or better than Ryan Giggs?
Well, the main reason is injury. He had already been away with the first team a couple of times. He was 6 months older than Ryan Giggs, played on the opposite wing to him in the youth team, and everybody from Gary Neville to basically everybody I spoke to, including Giggs himself, just said, look, you know, the two of them were, you know, you would mention him in the same breath. He would say, are you going down to the Cliff to watch Doherty and Giggs and the youth team? It would be those two, or Doherty and Wilson, as it was at the time. And those two were just exceptional talents. There was always a question mark with Doherty about whether he was quite as likely to make it long-term as Giggs was, just because he had a very different personality, he had very different interests, he didn't act like a footballer, he didn't dress like a footballer, he was, you know, always carrying a guitar around and wearing his scruffy clothes.
That's something I want to hit upon, Ollie, because you have this wonderful scene that you tell about this guy going with his guitar and a hat and busking on a street corner. I think it was actually near Old Trafford. I cannot imagine a highly rated 16, 17-year-old in an academy doing that, wanting to do that. It just seems that there's so much pressure for people to conform, to be, you know, good citizens, good footballers. Where did this come from? Or was it his family? Did it come from a family of creatives? Was it...
his dad was a, I mean, he's from Northern Ireland. His dad was a footballer of Derry City, and he was a big Bob Dylan fan. And Adrian got the same sort of Bob Dylan bug from a young age and was just obsessed with Bob Dylan. People would sort of assume he wanted to be the next George Best, which a lot of people were trying to tell him he was on course to be, and he really wanted to be the next Bob Dylan. And he wrote songs and he wrote poetry and he played his songs and, you know, read his poetry out at poetry nights. And that was the kind of guy he was, despite having this sort of Giggs level talent in terms of pure ability as a footballer, pure talent. He seemed to be at times indifferent to the idea of being a footballer. I think he found it very hard when he went over to Manchester. It wasn't quite what he'd always imagined a sort of life as a young footballer, a young professional footballer to be. And I think his sort of experience of those first, that first year at Old Trafford, homesickness and one or two other things, really kind of slightly put him on off the football side, maybe made him see more of a job. But at the same time, he was still going so well on the pitch that he was going away with the first team. He was going away with the first team ahead of Giggs. And around the time that he got injured, which was the big issue with it, in February 91, he and Giggs and Dan Ferguson had all been told that they were about to sort of be integrated into the first team squad, because it was an extreme injury crisis at the time. There was a huge fixture pile-up with Littlewoods Cup and Cup Winners' Cup, and he was going to be in the squad for the first team the following week, and yet he injured his knee playing in an 18 match against Carlisle United reserves, and basically he never recovered. And Giggs was the one who made his debut the following week, along with Dan Ferguson. And Giggs's life and career went in one direction, and Doherty's career and life went in another direction. It's remarkable the way it turned out, really.
I think it's scary. You know, my oldest son is 7 and he loves his football, and you would fear what happens if he gets to that age, 16, 17. Not just a big club at United and
sure, what
such
are you
a big
afraid
prospect.
About that he might have interests outside football, like music?
But no, it's not that. It's that you also, it's one thing that, you know, people dream to be a football player and young kids especially, but that they need to have something else as well in case it doesn't work out. And so many kids, I think, get to 16, 17, get released, get injured, get just not good enough for something, and then have nothing left. And what do you do next then? What do you do after that? And I think that's, as much as you know, you want your kid to succeed and this and that, I don't think anyone is ready for what happened to Adrian, for example. And I've got the book, Ollie. I haven't read it. It's you know, I've got a few that I need to read. But what happened then? Was it depression, or was he actually relieved in a way, because he clearly seemed that he wanted also to do something else, and at least he had that? But a lot of other kids don't have anything else but football, and if they don't make it, if they get that injury, then it's, you know, the downfall is pretty big.
Yeah, it's a good question to ask. And he remained a Manchester United player for another 2 years, because he had a 2 years left on his contract, which initially was meant to be a 5-year contract, and he turned down a 5-year contract because he said he wasn't sure he wanted to be a footballer for the next 5 years. He thought, hang on, you know, maybe sign 3 years and then we'll see how it goes.
Today, right, he would be like Dominic Solanke or something, and sign a 5-year contract for £2 million a year.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, the contract he was offered was the biggest that United had ever offered somebody who was just finishing an apprenticeship.
Right. And it was probably like £300 a week.
Yeah.
It was £200 a week plus bonuses when he played for United's first team, when he played for Northern Ireland, and when it was going to improve as he went up the ladder. And, you know, no doubt, had he made his first team debut, he would have begun to earn quite well. And the contract he'd been on before was £29.50 a week with his apprenticeship, so, you know, to go from that to £200 a week plus bonuses was going to be a big deal, and that's a sign of how they rated him, and that's the contract that they ended up offering Giggs, and 6 months later, when he turned 17, obviously Giggs signed for the whole 5 years. But to get back to the question, having got injured, he basically spent the next 2 years trying to get fit, but as he suffered one sort of setback after another, I mean, his heart went from he sort of ended up almost giving up on trying to get fit and gave up on the dream because he could see that these younger guys like Beckham and Keith Gillespie and Nicky Butt, Paul Scholes, people like that were coming in behind him and overtaking him, and so his contract drifted towards the end, and it was probably a relief really when he left at the end of that contract. He ended up playing back in Ireland for Derry City for a month or so, but it was basically he just completely turned his back on football and was happiest that way. He didn't want to play football. He didn't want to kind of go down the divisions and find a level where he could play competently. He just thought, well, I haven't made it at Manchester United because of the injury. That's happened. I move on. I'll do something else. And what he wanted to do was his music and his poetry. And
it's certainly a remarkable story, and I think one that should probably give us all cause to reflect, and maybe football too, about maybe the way it can cater to people who fall away and also people who don't quite fit the mold. The book is Forever Young, and it's a story of Adrian Doherty. One issue this week, a tweet. This is funny because we all know about the Sergio Aguero elbow, not elbow, wrist, whatever it was, on Winston Reid. Mark Halsey, former referee, you may know him, cancer survivor as well. He says a tweet, but it was actually, from what I could tell, and Julian, you might, and all of you guys might know more about this, it was actually a response to somebody, which means that some schlub somewhere went through the trouble of going through Mark Halsey's timeline, unless he was tweeting with somebody at whatever paper published it. But anyway, it turned into a story, and Halsey said that the PGMOL, which is the body that runs the referees, oversees the referees association, had told them sometimes to say that he had not seen an incident, when in fact he had. Bear in mind, too, that Mark Halsey and the PGMOL did not leave each other on good terms. And Howard Webb, of course, the very famous referee as well from 2010, who writes a column for us in the game. And he says that he was never actually told, to say that he had not seen an incident, which he had seen. But then he cites the Balotelli stamp on Scott Parker, which I personally didn't have a problem with, but anyway. But I suppose, strictly speaking, did warrant a suspension. I think he called the foul, but then he didn't send him off, and then he was asked about it, and he genuinely hadn't seen the stamp. I suppose it was the angle or whatever. But I think this is an interesting story because there's a concept within FIFA which says we cannot allow re-refereeing of matches. So this is why it exists. This is why if a referee has not seen, or if a referee says he has seen the incident, then unless he has made a technical mistake, in other words, if he's seen the incident, oh, look, I saw the incident clearly. He clearly fisted the ball into the net, but I chose to let the goal stand, in which case he hasn't applied the rules correctly. But if he has seen the incident, even if TV pictures suggest otherwise, there can be no further action taken. I think Halsey's implication is that PGMOL told referees, okay, write in your report that, or when we come back to you, that you did not see the incident so that we can go and punish people and apply video evidence. This is a really tricky one, I find, Ollie, as Howard writes as well. I know why FIFA do not allow referees to re-referee, but should they maybe soften their stance a little in light of situations like this?
Yeah, they should. And if the FA or the Premier League or the Football League or English football as a whole feels that they are a little too constrained, they've got the option within reason to set their own rules. And this is something they've hidden behind, I think, for far too long. And they have moderated the rules slightly. That there is now a little bit more scope for people call it re-refereeing, but retrospective action, retrospective punishments when incidents like this aren't punished at the time. But I just think it seems like there's almost any excuse not to take action at times. And it means that when there's an incident like this one, which was a high-profile one, not because it's Manchester City, as Manchester City fans seem convinced, it is that there's some kind of pre-derby match conspiracy, but it's a high-profile incident because it's a high-profile club and a high-profile player doing something which, you know, was bound to get a punishment if seen. And it's been, I mean, there is this question of whether Andrea Marino, the referee, saw it at the time. There's a suggestion that, well, there's a belief that he probably did see it and just underestimated what had happened. And I think that for him to have sort of admitted not having seen it.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So that the FA could take the action under their sort of strange rules and strange disciplinary process is really strange. I've got no problem at all with the end result, which is a charge and a ban. But the process just always seems to be totally flawed and totally unsatisfactory.
Well, it's interesting, Julian, because Ollie, as we heard there, has one view. Howard Webb has an entirely different view. Writing again in our paper today, next to an excellent spread about the Pep Mourinho rivalry, I might add. He makes the point that this is intended for retrospective action, is intended for incidents that have not been seen. But if you ask a referee, did you see it, you're kind of implying like, oh, look, you were wrong in your judgment. So obviously Howard doesn't like it. And he makes the point he doesn't want referees to become just remote controlled referees, maybe with video evidence reviewing their work. Now, bearing in mind that Howard Webb is a former law enforcement officer, yep, and after Brexit, your position is in, yep, peril here. Who do you side with, Ollie or Howard?
My issue is, I think this is a stupid rule of like, has the referee seen it or not? Because if he missed the penalty because he hasn't seen it, we don't, you know, they don't take the penalty again. You know, we don't have.
But
an extra
we do
5 minutes.
for violent
yeah,
conduct.
Yeah, but
which is what we're talking about here.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, whether you think the incident, whether the referee has seen it or not, and if like Ollie was saying, he might not have realised on that split second that, you know, he might have thought that Aguero didn't touch.
So you're in favour of re-refereeing, basically.
But yeah, but because how many times... It's not really re-refereeing.
Why?
How many times has it happened?
If Andre Mariner says, I have seen this, and in my judgment, I'm the referee, the rules say I get to decide, I've seen the incident, and it's not a red card.
Yeah.
Case closed.
Yeah.
You can have all your video evidence. Once I tell you I've seen it, you can put your video evidence...
But then why don't they meet up? And they said, okay, we're gonna show you the video because maybe you didn't realize that, you know, you didn't
really
make contact and something. Yeah, I saw it, but I saw it live, and I also had something in the corner of my eyes and something, because I also had to follow the ball and I had to follow this and, right, I had to follow that.
But basically, you are advocating re-refereeing and video technology, and you guys are both disagreeing with Howard Webb.
Also,
you do
finish,
so at your peril.
That thing about referees, why are they not allowed to talk after games? Why can't they come out and do an interview and say, listen, I've seen that again, I got that one wrong, or there was a penalty there? Why is that whole omerta around you know, referees and treat them the way they are treated.
On that point, I actually kind of agree.
I disagree.
Oh, interesting. I'll tell you why I agree with Julian, and you can tell me why you disagree. But I think if people explained what they saw in that moment, I think they would become more human, and we would get more educated. And I think we'd also lose this total false pretense that all referees are created equal and they're all equally competent, because they're not. Some referees are better. Some have a better personality. They're better at man management. They simply see things better and make more correct decisions. But Ollie, you get the final word.
I disagree with it because it's going to be is them explaining why they've made mistakes. And it's obvious why they've made mistakes. It's obvious why Andre Mariner didn't give a red card. It's because, as Julian said, he didn't see it properly. It was right within his line of vision, but he clearly wasn't totally convinced that it was that kind of offence. And so. It's always really obvious what the decision made. Even those penalties at Stoke the other week where everyone's saying, oh, what's he seen there? It's obvious what he's seen or thought he's seen. And to me, it's just sort of undermining the credibility of referees more rather than strengthening it. And I think it wouldn't do referees a favour. It might sort of add to the sort of pantomime villain aspect. It might play into the hands of the media to have these people dragged out in front of the cameras to explain things, but it's always obvious why people make decisions, almost always.
In our debate this week, we were supposed to talk about something else, but for legal reasons, we won't be doing that. We'll be talking Manchester Derby and the specifically Pep and Mourinho. It's one vantage point on this. This is a story that's going to dominate. There is a narrative whereby, because they were together at Barcelona, in fact, we run a wonderful photograph of the two of them at Barcelona. And the reason I love this photograph, and I appreciate this podcast, you can't see the photograph, but you know what? If you Google it, it'll probably be the first thing that comes up because it's a very famous photograph. And you're tempted to look at this and see, oh, look, they're sitting down on the training pitch. Look, they're friends, and then somehow, you know, it's Cain and Abel, they grow apart, neither one has murdered the other yet, but there's still time for that. But if you look at the picture carefully, it's obviously a snapshot, but there is such a contrast. Pep is wearing a dark top, Mourinho, a light top. Pep's sitting with his arms against his knees. It's almost like he's guarded. Mourinho is sitting all the way back with his legs wide open. I mean, he looks like he is totally, totally relaxed. They're looking in different directions. They almost kind of look like when you have a conversation at a party, somebody kind of looks past to see if somebody more interesting is coming to talk to. Not that that's ever happened to me. I don't know that they were ever quite on the wavelength. Certainly that's the impression I was given when I reported the story. Ollie, we're incessantly fascinated by this simply because they are, I mean, this is almost biblical, right? The contrast between these two. Yet they've only been in the same league once for 2 years. Do we need this added layer? I mean, is it something that you look at and you say, this is a great lens through which to watch the Manchester Derby next week? What's your take?
I imagine we'll get sick of it in some ways. I imagine it could get nasty.
How can you get sick of it, though? I get sick of the Bible. I don't want to hear about the Good Samaritan one more time, right?
I think it is fascinating, I'm really looking forward to this game. I'm looking forward to the theatre surrounding it, even though I was poo-pooing the entertainment industry aspect earlier. But we as a media in this country are always obsessed with the personalities of the managers, and often more so the personalities and the caricatures than what the managers actually do, how they operate. And I think, you know, we've got two managers who are totally different styles, never mind totally different personalities. I think that is going to be really interesting how that plays out over the next 3 years. But I can see because of the way maybe one of them is more than the other, it will just get a bit cartoon-like and a bit Punch and Judy over the course of time. I'm really looking forward to this first one, but and generally the City United rivalry being revived and reinvigorated by these two, but I imagine it could get very wearisome if as it seemed to do towards the second season that they were both in Spain. It seemed like it just sort of exhausted Guardiola and was probably a big factor in sort of making him move away from Barcelona.
A slightly fundamental difference, and I know the Premier League people won't like this when I say this, but there was a much bigger connection, I think, certainly for Guardiola and Barca, but I think also for Mourinho at Real Madrid, having got to the pinnacle of club football. Mm-hmm. And I think, you can say United are just as big as Real Madrid, but the point is Real Madrid was Mourinho's first job at the very pinnacle of club football. They were younger, maybe they were less mature. You had the whole background, the whole Catalan, Castilian thing going on. Were these all these other layers, a much more rabid press, two different parts of the country? Manchester is pretty small. It's a city, of course, but it's not. we're not talking about something that divides a nation. Right, we're talking about two big successful clubs. I kind of feel that in England there's not more maturity about it, but you don't have all these layers that you necessarily had back then. But then again, I live inside the M25 and you don't, Ollie. So am I wrong on this?
I think that's pretty much right, what you say, in that there was that sort of political aspect. There's the media is very much polarized in Spain between pro Madrid and pro Barcelona, it's not like that over here. It's probably a case of who can get bragging rights each time and who's top of the table. But it is going to be a huge thing as to which, not only who wins on Sunday or Saturday, but or who wins the title, but who gets the upper hand over this. Over these next 3 years, if we were to assume that the two of them both are here for 3 years, which is probably the maximum either would do, who is going to sort of win the war, as it were? The second war between them, I'm hearing myself now, and I'm talking about it as a war, but it is. Two clubs. I don't want it always to be portrayed as Guardiola versus is Mourinho, Pep versus Jose. There are teams, there are clubs, and I'm well up for the kind of Punch and Judy narrative of it this week. But I in the long term, I hope the City United rivalry can be more than that, more than a massive personality clash between two guys who are great managers, never mind great names. They're great managers, great coaches. Very different
but
personalities.
Julian, if the managers overshadowed Barcelona and Real Madrid when Barcelona had Messi and Cristiano was at Real Madrid, you look at United, Mourinho always overshadows anything, everything. And maybe Pogba one day will reach that level. If you look at the other end, there's phenomenal players, but there aren't outsize, in-your-face personalities on the City end. In fact, maybe between the two clubs, it's really only Pogba and Ibrahimovic, and they both just got here, and Ibrahimovic presumably won't be around that long. So is it kind of inevitable that our narrative for a while will be actually about the two managers?
Yeah, and I just that's where I slightly disagree with Ollie. I want more of it. I want them to play in the League Cup. I want them to play in the FA Cup. Sure. I want replays. I want them to play in Europe. Not in Europe, but next season in Europe. I want them all the time. I want to see what they're going to do tactically on Saturday. I want to see what Jose comes up with against Pep, because I don't think Pep is going to change much.
They could yet face each other in Europe, by the way.
They could still, true.
Right, how about some quick hits? There's only going to be four this week because there's only two of you and because as exciting as the week of football is. We had all those freaking friendlies first. We only had one day. Ah, I don't want to think about what happened. Please, league football, come back. I really love international football. I want to give it a shot. But they make it hard this week. Chelsea make the biggest splash on transfer deadline day, picking up David Luiz. Julian, is this a clever, calculated risk?
You've said enough. It's a risk. And why would you take that risk? I don't understand. It was a big surprise. It came to a big surprise to me. It came to a big surprise at PSG that Chelsea were ready to spend so much money on David Luiz 2 years after letting him go. I don't think he's as good as he was when he left. I think he's a worse player. I'm sorry. I know you disagree, Gab. But I'm just so shocked and surprised to see Chelsea doing that deal.
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that all their other targets seemed to seem to disappear. Yeah. And
it was the seventh or eighth choice, yeah.
And eventually...
Entirely because people say, the asking rate is 60 million because you got 50 million to have for David Luiz.
Matthew Syed's column today talks about Manchester City and how the Abu Dhabi investment is sort of a hedge by the royal family of the Emirate, a protection, if you will, against getting overthrown perhaps by their own people or maybe taken over by some of the bigger, more powerful countries nearby like Saudi Arabia and Iran. You're a pretty serious guy, so you get to deal with this one, Ollie. Is this something City fans should be thinking about? Oh, look, the absolute monarch of a country with a so-so human rights record has bought us because he thinks that will save him from being overthrown by democracy-loving people or maybe invaded by Iran or Saudi or whatever.
Or that the money runs out once the fuel runs out. It's about preserving Abu Dhabi's place in the world. I've written about that previously myself as well. It's true that is the strategic reason, the geopolitical reason why Abu Dhabi bought Manchester City, or what Sheikh Mansour bought Manchester City. That is why, and in that sense, yes, that.
It's not because Sheikh Mansour grew up with a poster of Mike Summerby on his wall.
No, not even Lee Bradbury or anybody like that. But it's you know, from Abu Dhabi's view, that is what Manchester City are. They are a pawn in a bigger game. Obviously, to Manchester City's point of view, Manchester City fans' point of view, it's all about Man City, and rightly so. They should be aware of that dimension, and if they're not, I don't suppose it does any harm to read that, unless they just end up convinced that the media's against them.
Okay, so at one point on transfer deadline day, we think Moussa Sissoko he's definitely going to Everton, and then he ends up at Spurs. Juliet, it's two questions. One is, what happened? We know you've got the inside track on this because you tweeted a selfie of yourself and Moussa celebrating outside White Hart Lane. But also, it's a lot of money to spend for a guy who really was pretty bad last year, wasn't he? I mean, we're inconsistent. I mean, gifted player. And also, is he a natural fit, too?
Yeah, let me tell you about the story of Little Moussa. Little Moussa was not happy anymore in Newcastle. Things didn't really work out for
him. He's
not
that little, is he? He's bigger than you.
He's Little Moussa. Little Moussa was not happy. He wanted to leave. Didn't want to play in the Championship. Almost ready to go anywhere, really, in the Premier League or in Europe. A few clubs were interested. Everton were actually met the valuation made by Newcastle of £30 million. They were happy to take, you know, five payments of £6 million. Everybody was happy. Little Moussa was okay about Everton. He wanted to play Champions League football. Everton didn't offer that, but he thought, okay, he's still good. So he was on his way from London, where he was based, to Liverpool and Everton.
Why does he live in London?
No, he was with France. He was with France in Paris. But instead of going to Italy with the rest of the national team, he went to London to sort out his transfer, basically, because it was deadline day.
Because there's no Paris to John Lennon Airport.
I guess it's quicker if you're in London already go to Liverpool to sign for Everton. So here he is on the M1, and then I guess
Why did he take the train? He didn't want to do a Jeremy Corbyn.
But that's a good detail, because on the train he wouldn't have been able to do a U-turn. But he was in the car, And then the phone rang, and it was Spurs, and Spurs actually said, okay, we're going to meet the £30 million valuation, so if you want, you can come to us, and we've got Champions League to offer. So Lethal Moussa was really happy again, and he thought, yes, that's what I want. So they did a U-turn on the motorway, went back down to London, he signed for Spurs. It's a lot of money, but if you get the Sissoko from the Euros, then it's maybe not so much. If you get the Sissoko from Newcastle, then it's pretty a lot of money.
If, doesn't the Sissoko from the Euros play in Dele Alli's position?
He
more so than the Dembele, Wanyama, Dyer position.
He played in the Lamela position. He played in on the right hand side of that 4-4-2 with Griezmann.
Whatever
and
you
Giroud
want to call it, an attacking midfield position.
But really on the right hand side, and I don't see. Well, I guess he can play there for Spurs, but that's for me. That's his best position. On the right-hand side.
But surely, given that Eric Lamela is the greatest, most talented player in the Premier League.
It's £30 million to sit on the bench then.
And it, well, unless this Christian Eriksen situation, which I can, obviously none of us for legal reasons can go into more issues, is a lot more serious than we thought.
Maybe. But he brings them something, you know, I think a bit different and something else if right. Mauricio wants to tweak things.
Okay, so we went way over in our normal time limit on this Moussa Sissoko thing.
Moussa.
But it's okay.
It's Little Moussa.
Little Moussa. And besides, we only have six quick kids. We only have four quick kids. True. Instead of six. We're going to end with Captain Jack. Mr. Wilshire decides on deadline day, or Arsenal decide for him, that, hey, look, you're free to go on loan somewhere else because you'll just get injured again and never play. So it doesn't really matter. No, just kidding. Because, you know, you need playing time and whatever. Now, I'm going to ask you, Ollie, first of all, it's a story that he turned down Crystal Palace to go to Bournemouth. Is that true? And if it is true, doesn't it prove that he's actually not a little weak guy who just wants to stay in his comfort zone because he's moving all the way from London to the wild South Coast?
Well, it's, you know, once you're in Croydon at Crystal Palace, you're halfway there anyway. But it's... From what I was told, it had more to do with style and with management. And that's not a massive...
Oh, you're having a go
on
Pardew. I love it.
Yes, I love that, Ollie.
If you were Jack Wilshire, you could see that... Well, look, if you're dropping down from Arsenal to Palace, why would you not drop down from Arsenal to Bournemouth if you felt that style was more... suited to your own. I can totally understand
this is a setup question because I wanted to set you up. I'm going to send you an alley-oop so that I could go and have a go at Pards. But in reality, if I'm not mistaken, there's already a player named Johan Kabay who plays for Crystal Palace who does a lot of the things that in Roy Hodgson's fantasies Jack Wilshire is supposed to be doing on a regular basis when he's not injured, right? So given that they only generally play with one ball, the Wilshire-Kabay coexistence, not so obvious. At Bournemouth, it's a slightly different situation. I mean, you're saying that's the basis of this decision, right?
Well, that's the basis for choosing Bournemouth over Palace, yeah. I mean, you could look at Kabay's experience at Palace and you say, does that team particularly suit Kabay? I don't think it particularly does. And I'm not picking Crystal Palace or Pardew. What they do works well for them, but I don't think it particularly gets the best out of Kabay. I don't think it would have got the best out of Wilshire. And you know, I would say they would have been one of the Premier League clubs that would have suited him least. And whereas Bournemouth, I mean, obviously a much smaller club than Arsenal, probably a smaller club than Palace, but the style, the role, you know, the type of coach Eddie Howe is will probably suit more. And I remember, I think I did the. I think it was the first newspaper interview with Wilshire when he was on loan at Bolton back in 2010, I think. And he said then, I mean, he was only 18 and he didn't say very much in the interview. He was very shy at that point. And he actually said, you know, one of the reasons I chose Bolton was because I like the way that they're playing under Owen Cole. They pass it. They do this. They play through midfield. And he had chosen Bolton over other Premier League clubs because he felt that they would suit his style. And I think it's a similar decision here. It's, you know, I think the big decision was the decision to go on loan from Arsenal. I think the sort of destination was probably a less difficult decision.
Thank you, Roy Hodgson.
Gab, one for you. The transfer window this summer in England reached a record £1.2 billion. Are you surprised?
Well, first of all, Julian, that number, as you know, is kind of stupid and meaningless because that is the amount of money Premier League clubs spent, but a lot of that was done trading with each other, so it's actually money recirculating.
Yeah.
What's really relevant, I think, is the £700 million, which has left the Premier League, not all of it going abroad, some of it going to the lower divisions, the bulk of it going abroad. And we have a situation where it's basically sort of cross-subsidizing, bankrolling other European leagues. You could say that in this post-Brexit or post-potential or post-Brexit vote era, it is an example of what trade can do and trickle-down effects and specialization. Some people going so much as saying that what we're going to see now is other European leagues specializing in creating players and then selling them to the Premier League, where I suppose they make them the next step and whatever else. I don't know if we're going to quite go that far. It's not like footballers are raw materials, but if you go back to economics 101, right, some countries go and like they'll mine iron and then they'll send it somewhere else and then they'll turn the iron into some kind of finished product, into steel, and then they go somewhere else and then the steel becomes whatever, girders or whatever they kind of steel. But you know, you get the point.
Yeah.
Right? It is an interesting situation that has emerged, and I think it's one that we don't quite fully understand yet and that no doubt we'll be talking about further. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my guests, Julian Lawrence and Ollie Kay. It was just the two of them, and it was so much better because they are two of the very best guests, as voted by you, the audience of the Game podcast. Now, remember, you can sign up for The Times online. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. You get all the benefits and goodies that come along with that. And look, you can subscribe to us as in our podcast. Wherever it is you get your podcasts, we're going to be back in 7.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Days time. Till next time, ta-ta.